Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. And as always, I'm wishing you the best. We love to hear from you. You can get in touch by going to naturalnurse.com. And if you click on calendar, you will see the many classes and workshops that are available, both online and on ground. For instance, we have one coming up next week on women's health, and that one is online, so you can participate from anywhere that you are, literally in the world. And it does hold 3 CEU credits: nurses, midwives, massage therapists, acupuncturists, nutritionists, ORDs, and that is coming right up. Also, we have one that's specifically for RDs, but free to anyone, and that's going to be on how to use berberine. Berberine is the active constituent found in many plants, such as golden seal, and has a really amazing antimicrobial action. And in addition, it does not create the evolution of resistant microbial strains, which is something that regular antibiotics do. So anyone is welcome to join in on that. That is free and open to the public and has CE credits. So check out all the offerings. Perhaps you want to go in an herb walk and actually gather edible and medicinal plants and make them into medicine. The next workshop in that is coming up at Hippocrates Institute in Florida in January. We have a big class already, but I think there's room for some more. And that, we spend the day out in the woods actually gathering wild edible and medicinal plants, and you go home with your own medicine. And we have that class several times a year all over in the United States as well as in Jamaica, West Indies. So lots of classes to choose from. Just go to naturalnurse.com. You can get on the newsletter just by putting your email in the lower left-hand corner. Or you can go to calendar and join in any of the classes. Or look at many of our books. We've written 12 books. So lots of information there at naturalnurse.com. And thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And I said we're going to go out and gather edible and medicinal plants, and that really is a segue into our wonderful guest today, and that is Dr. Keisha Gather. She is a medical doctor, and she's double board certified in OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine. And Dr. Gather is the director of perinatal services at Lincoln Medical and Mental Health Center in the Bronx, New York. For many years, she has been named America's top obstetrician and gynecologist by the Consumer Research Council. She received her Bachelor's of Science degree in biology from Barnard College and her medical degree from SUNY Health Science Center in Syracuse, as well as a Master's in Public Health in Health Policy and Management from Columbia University. With more than 20 years of professional experience, driven by her mission to provide exemplary prenatal care to all women, regardless of circumstance, Dr. Gather positively impacts the lives of thousands of women by delivering valuable information on a spectrum of women's health issues, and which she'll be doing with us today. And she is often a contributor to the Huffington Post, Thrive Global, and U.S. News and World Report. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Gather.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly. And am I pronouncing your name right?
Keisha Gather.
Gather. I said Gather, so it's Gather. So thank you for the correction, and we'll remember that as we move forward. In any event, I want to go back in time to where you were a little girl. And what made you, when did you have that concept that you want to be a doctor?
Well, my mother said that when I was 4 years old, I was running around telling people I wanted to be a surgeon. So I think I was probably born with that desire. She also said I had a lot of little stuffed animals that had a lot of operations, and she actually kept one where I could actually see. I did a lot of surgeries on that little stuffed animal, so I guess it was already there.
So you know, she knew that you had an interest in that. And then what
Most
about
definitely.
When you attended school, did you move towards an interest in, you know, becoming a doctor is a big deal. You have to be good in science. So was that something that you actually found yourself drawn to even in the younger
absolutely.
Years?
Absolutely. Absolutely. All the science shows I watched, I was in a lot of AP classes. So yeah, I was your typical little nerdy science girl. So definitely science and math I excelled in. I have to say that. Yeah.
So that was your path from the beginning.
Right and, from the beginning.
Yeah, and what was it that made you go further and not only become so medically qualified as you are, but also move into the health sciences in terms of sort of like the political arena of public health and health policy and management?
Well, you know, I think that a lot of the illnesses that we see are really due to our environment and our food. And, you know, those things kind of fall into the public health arena. And I think it behooved me to have a working knowledge of how that worked and how to impact my community and my patients. So I think that was a smart move to know not only the medical aspect, but also the public health aspect and how those two intertwine to, you know, bring forth some really good outcomes as far as making policies and procedures that will help the community.
And it certainly does. And boy, that's a hot topic because it seems to be evolving even as we speak.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
You know, one wonders where the funds are going to continue to come from to support people who do need, like you talk about, having access to all kinds of community members.
Exactly.
And, you know, I know in many places right now, there's actually a lot of worry about that continuing to be available. So we'll have to see what
mm-hmm.
happens. But
Absolutely.
Knowing you, someone like you, is so crucial when there are issues because you could be, you know, not that you want to work 27 hours a day, but you certainly could be instrumental in supporting the availability of programs that increase access to all individuals.
Absolutely, particularly to our underserved.
So true. I also wanted to ask you, this is not something that I know we're going to be talking about, city life and all that. I just also mm-hmm. wanted to ask you about, you know, culturally competent training. We do a lot of that because I'm a nurse and I train nurses in holistic nursing. And we talk a lot about that when you're living, particularly in an urban environment, but there are also rural areas where this is the situation. And the patients actually have a knowledge of and a desire to incorporate traditional healing modalities. And it might be the use of herbs or certain kinds of prayers. How do you feel about that?
I think that's fine as long as they let the doctor know that's what they're doing. And, you know, there's some type of investigation to make sure that the ingredients that they're ingesting, you know, are not harmful to either them or the fetus, particularly to the fetus.
If they're pregnant, right. If they're pregnant,
right.
And that's,
mm-hmm.
of course, your patient
exactly.
population. Well, a yeah. lot of my training has to do with, in terms of culturally competent interaction on the part of the healthcare provider, is I do believe they have to come with an open attitude or they're not going to hear about those things being used. A lot of the situations are that the people using them are very fearful of sharing that with their health provider.
That's a true statement there. That's a true statement. But, you know, hopefully, and it hasn't happened thus far, you know, I think my patients feel comfortable enough to tell me, you know, what they're taking and, you know, how they're taking it and why they're taking it. So, you know, we can kind of come to some mutually beneficial, I guess, ground. So they're happy and I'm happy.
Absolutely. And that is so important because there are things like herb-drug interactions. And if they're taking a lot of herbs, let's say, that are blood thinners, or in the fact, let's say golden seal that I mentioned earlier, it's an excellent antibiotic, but it has a mild oxytoxic effect. So you certainly would never want to be using it in early pregnancy.
Exactly.
So those are really, you know, important things, I think, to create an atmosphere of safety on the part of the health provider to be trained to allow people to share with them so that they could do better health care.
Well, I keep a little reference book in here of all of, you know, at least most of some of the herbal supplements. So I have a quick reference where I can kind of look up and, you know, see if I'm not familiar with it, whether or not this is going to be something that's going to be compatible with, you know, with their pregnancy. So that kind of works out well.
Yeah, it's excellent. And I'm sure you're the kind of doctor who actually allows people to share without being judgmental. So that you'll hear that information.
Exactly. You've got to hear it. You've got to hear it. It's important.
Now, a lot of what you talk about is inner city, and that's because that's where you are. And there are special health concerns for people who are living in a city environment. And I guess that's, you know, really a specialty of yours. So how does urban versus rural living, how would that affect your health differently?
Well, when you're in a rural environment, you know, there are not that many buildings around. And it's you're in the open spaces, so you have access to a lot of sunlight. When you are in an urban environment, you've got a lot of tall buildings around. You're in the buildings a lot. You're either traveling on the bus or you're traveling underground in the subway system. So your access to sunlight is greatly impaired. And, you know, there are certain vitamins that you can become depleted of, depending on where you live. Now, as humans, we make vitamin D in our skin, and vitamin D is accelerated by sunlight. So if you're in an urban environment, you're not getting a lot of sunlight, and we know that vitamin D is made in our skin, then that's going to be a problem. It's even more of a problem if you are a person of color. People of color don't make as much vitamin D in their skin. So that can become problematic for you. Vitamin D is really important in a lot of the body's functions as far as your bone development. It's associated with the deficiency anyway is associated with an increased risk of depression. And for my arena, there's some studies that are denoting that a deficiency of vitamin D increases your risk of having premature birth. So I think, for me, that's a pretty important vitamin for me to kind of eyeball and make people aware of.
And it seems that many people are, thank goodness, many physicians and family care practitioners, because I review blood work all the time, and it seems like many people are testing it. Of course, there are different tests that you can order, and it seems that the 25-hydroxy might be the best test to really see what the tissue level is of vitamin D versus just, you know, a serum analysis.
Right. Mm-hmm. That would be correct.
So when you're writing for it, that's what you would say. And it would be great to train more physicians because they don't necessarily know that, because they probably haven't heard about it like in medical school, for instance.
Well, I can't say what's going on now, but I can honestly say that when I was training, that certainly wasn't in the curriculum.
Isn't that a shame that doctors wouldn't be highly trained in all aspects of nutrition, since even, as you know, right in the Merck manual, this is not, you know, new age knowledge, it clearly says a lot of information on nutrients. For instance, the fact that many pharmaceutical drugs deplete nutrients. So how cost effective would it be to just also recommend the use of that supplement with what we know that particular pharmaceutical might deplete at the same time to decrease right. adverse effects.
Right. But, you know, oftentimes, at least, you know, for me, I know we didn't get that. So that's something that's knowledge that you have to kind of build on your own by researching it on your own and you know, making adjustments in the manner in which you approach patients accordingly.
Right. Well, you know, there should be no end of learning. And
It never is. It never is.
No, it never is, because you, doctor, are a learning addict. I bet
yeah,
I can say that. And I am, too.
You know,
I mean, nobody has this number of degrees. You know, there's a certain point beyond which you're not doing it to make extra funds. You know, you're only doing it to increase your knowledge base. And that comes from
exactly.
a very desire of wanting to really keep up with all the latest information. So that's so mm-hmm. wonderful that your patients get that expertise. Now, do you actually see patients, or are you also involved in training staff?
I see patients. I operate on patients sometimes, depending on what the case is. I train residents. Because Lincoln has a residency program here. I train sonography students. We have two schools rotating through here. One of my loves in perinatal medicine is antenatal diagnosis. So, you know, we have a perinatal unit here where we scan a lot of patients, do all the antenatal testing. And also I have my hands in some research. So those are all my loves. And it just it serves for a well-rounded approach to medical care
and
in the community
day.
That I serve.
A busy day. And someone who's certainly investigating all the newest knowledge. And let me mm-hmm. just ask you this. In terms of research, is there anything new that you're doing that you think might be interesting for people to know about that might be on, you know, cutting edge of what we'll know about years from now?
Well, I just applied for a grant so I can do some research on preterm labor and vitamin D, so we'll see how that goes.
Oh, that's excellent. I myself applied to be part of a vitamin D study that's been that's going on out of Winthrop University.
Oh,
and
really?
It was obviously a different patient population, which is, you know, people over, maybe the geriatric crowd, like that's who I'm in. And you had to meet certain requirements, and I went in for the initial review. And they turned me down as a subject because my levels were not low enough. In other words, they're looking for people who are low to even be in the study.
Oh, okay.
That's one of their parameters, okay. Because then they initiate a placebo and a vitamin D, you know, being given over a
uh-huh.
certain amount of time, and then they retest, and then they're evaluating parameters like bone density and things like that. So it's not your patient population, but obviously they are doing that, something with vitamin D as well, so that's interesting on how much play vitamin D is getting. It's really amazing how such a small thing, which of course is not really a vitamin when we look at the complexity of its chemistry. I would say it's almost more a hormone, and it functions that way too. It gives signals to the body to take certain actions.
It does. And it's so interesting because, you know, I started having an interest in this maybe about 2 or 3 years ago. And, you know, I was going to the doctor, and I was just so tired, so tired, so tired. So he checked everything, and he checked my vitamin D level. Now, a normal level is like 20 to 40. Mine was 9. So there is something to be said for, you know, vitamin D kind of giving you a boost and helping with your cardiovascular system and everything else like that. Certainly once I started supplementing, and honestly say I've certainly got my energy back, that's for sure, but you know, I needed supplementation.
Absolutely. So isn't it wonderful that the test to do it is not that expensive?
No, it's not.
I think it's usually covered by most health insurances, and then the treatment is very inexpensive. You can get an excellent quality vitamin D without spending, you know, a fortune at all.
You know, and for those people who don't wish to ask their doctors to test their levels, there are certain sites where you can determine your own vitamin D levels by getting a kit. There's a website by the name of nutrientpower.org. You can purchase your own self-test kit there for a minimal amount of money. And also on that site, there's a lot of information on the various types of vitamins and deficiencies and so forth that can come from, you know, not having adequate supplementation of various vitamins. So that's a pretty good site.
It's a great site. And let's give that out again. And that is, you can write it down, listeners, Nutrient Power, pretty easy to remember, .org. And what I love about that site is they really have the best science. If you were to just go Google supplements, you're going to get, you know, to various who knows who, who's selling things, you know, and this is quite vetted. I mean, you see that someone as highly educated and as into patient wellness as Dr. Keisha Gaither is telling us that this is a good site. I've reviewed it. They've also made it very, you know, friendly. It doesn't look like something you need to be a doctor to understand. It's an easy read, but it's all evidence-based. I think it's a great site. Also, in terms of testing, they have various tests available that you can pay for if you're so inclined. But what it does is it actually puts you into a study base. So then you get all the feedback about what's going on, not just with yourself, but with thousands of others. So I think it's just a great resource. I'm so happy that it's around. And it seems to be, you know, kind of continually developing and getting even better and better. So thank you so much for sharing that. We're going to go to a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we'd love to hear from you. You can always reach out to us at naturalnurse.com and just send us an email or make a comment. And I do want to tell you that our guest today is Dr. Keisha Gaither, and we'll be talking about a lot more when we get back right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss an herb we all know and love, cinnamon.
Ah, spicy, sweet smell of cinnamon. Everyone recognizes the familiar aroma of this common kitchen spice. But did you know that cinnamon is an exotic plant bark with a long history of medicinal use in many countries throughout the world? Cinnamon was listed as an herb with medicinal properties in Chinese literature as early as 2700 BC. It is described in the Chinese medical text, the Tang Materia Medica, written in 659 AD. Cinnamon also enjoys traditional use in Ayurvedic medicine, the ancient healing art of India. It is mentioned in the Book of Moses and has been cultivated in Ceylon and Sri Lanka since 1200 AD, where much of the world's supply is still grown.
In Europe, cinnamon was regarded as a rare and precious spice. Many pharmaceutical substances such as cough syrups and digestive tonics contain cinnamon. It was also used as an incense and in perfumes. According to Chamberlain, writing in France in 1887, cinnamon possesses the greatest antiseptic properties. Cinnamon is gathered from the dried inner bark of the branches of a small tropical evergreen laurel tree. The bark is peeled off, and as the pieces are dried, they curl up into quills. These are the common cinnamon sticks that are used in herb teas and for baking.
In Chinese medicine, cinnamon is one of the most widely used warming herbs to aid in circulation and digestion. It is a common ingredient in small amounts in tea used for nausea during pregnancy. It is also used following delivery to decrease hemorrhage. Cinnamon raises vitality, warms and stimulates all the vital functions of the body, counteracts congestion, improves the digestive system, relieves abdominal spasms, and aids in peripheral circulation. The essential oils contained in cinnamon include eugenol, cinnaminic aldehyde, methyl eugenol, tannins, and mannitol, which give cinnamon its sweet flavor. It also contains cinzenolin and cinzenolol, which are both known insecticides.
Try putting some liquid soap and cinnamon in a spray bottle and use on plants as an organic bug repellent. Cinnamon is also included in many medicinal recipes that are used for lice, scabies, and other skin parasites. Cinnamon has antifungal, antiviral, and bactericidal activities. It has been shown to suppress E. coli, Staphylococcus, and Candida albicans.
So, listeners, the next time you inhale that sweet, spicy aroma, remember there's more to cinnamon than meets the nose as you reach into your natural medicine chest.
Welcome back once again right here to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. We love sharing with you on Progressive Radio Network for many reasons. It is the leading Progressive Radio Network. That's one thing. That's why that's its name. And also everything is archived for you. So if you see something or hear something, like on today's show with our wonderful guest, Dr. Keisha Gaither, and you want someone else to hear this great information, well, or you want to listen again, you can visit the archive. It's up usually in about a day or two. You can also go to naturalnurse.com radio shows. We post it there. And you can listen again. You can even download it. We don't block downloads. So you can use this content again and again or anytime you'd like, which is really a wonderful service. And to reintroduce our guest, Dr. Gaither, she's a double board certified physician, and she specializes in OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine. And she's the director of perinatal services at Lincoln Medical and Mental Health Center in the Bronx. Let's talk a little bit about the Bronx, Dr. Gaither, because that, most people know, is very much an urban area. And I know one
very
of your focuses
so.
Is specializing on those challenges for people living in the city.
Very much. I mean, you know, the Bronx is as urban as you can get it. Lots of tall buildings here, lots of people of color in the community that I serve, lots of morbidity and mortality, lots of pathology here, a lot of diabetes, a lot of hypertension. You name it, we got it.
And certainly living in an urban environment is part of the challenge, like with air pollution, I would imagine.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that air pollution can kind of do is to affect two vitamins. Now, vitamin C, living in the city means exposure to a lot of carbon monoxide, which destroys vitamin C. And as we all know, vitamin C is important for a number of things. It's important for your skin. It's important for your hair. It's important in the winter months to prevent you from getting a cold. And it also is important in your skin. Vitamin C has been known to help stimulate the production of collagen, and you know that's what makes your skin dewy and glowy and so forth and so on. So living in the city with the cars and their emissions and carbon monoxide can kind of destroy the vitamin C levels that you have in your body. So it's kind of important that you supplement yourself with foods that can supplement your vitamin C, like citrus fruits, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and my favorite, spinach and red peppers. Those are all good, you know, natural supplements, as well as, you know, taking supplemental vitamin C, for instance, when you think you're coming down with a cold. So that's all beneficial. The other vitamin that's affected by air pollution is vitamin B12. The World Health Organization estimates that about 92% of the world's population currently live in areas where the pollution exceeds safety guidelines. So, you know, there are a lot of sulfate and carbon emissions that come from cars and trucks and so forth and so on, which kind of switch off the cells in the immune system. And vitamin B12 is a nutrient that helps to keep the body's nerve and blood cells healthy and help to make DNA. So deficiency of it can also produce a particular type of anemia called megaloblastic anemia that, you know, makes you feel tired and weak and so forth and so on. So vitamin B12 supplementation is really important. And I would say it's particularly important in those people who have had, bariatric surgery where, you know, certain portions of their their GI system may or may not have been particularly affected by the surgery. So it's important to supplement yourself with some vitamin B12.
So where can someone, like, naturally get B12, let's say, from their diet?
You can get it from meat, you know, lean meat, beef.
So it is possible. And,
it,
you know,
possible.
That's really interesting. So it's another thing that really could be tested. Doctors should be testing B12 levels. They should be testing vitamin D levels. And, you know, actually there's many different things. Now, in terms of air pollution, what are some of the health issues that might be linked to urban air pollution? Or in the country, too. You know, in the country there's a lot of pollution, too, because there's sometimes really high levels of pesticides and sprays being thrown all over the place as well.
Well, I mean, the area that I'm working in, there is a lot of asthma. So it doesn't help to, you know, already have an underlying pulmonary issue and then have to contend with air pollution on top of that. That's only going to exacerbate it. So for my section of living, you know, asthma impacts it. Interestingly enough, there is a lot of cardiovascular disease among a lot of the pregnant patients that I'm seeing, and I'm not quite sure. I know that certainly diet has a lot to do with it, since a lot of my population is morbidly obese. But you know, there has to be something else going along with that, to such that I'm seeing so much cardiovascular disease, and certainly, you know, your environment can definitely impact on that. So. There you go.
Yeah, that's really true. Now, you did bring up diet, and I want to go into that a little bit more deeply, because there is some really interesting research that was done by someone who gave, it was actually a conference of people of color, as a matter of fact, and this doctor, he's an MD, and he did a study with a group that went to Israel as a group. It was a spiritual group from Chicago. And they were given land to set up a community. It was a group of Afro-Americans from Chicago, and this happened about 40 years ago. And they had a religious conviction to be mostly vegetarian, not eat salt, and exercise every day. It was part of their religious focus. Mm-hmm. He found out about them and thought it would be really interesting after 40 years to go visit those people and then also visit their own relatives who had remained in Chicago with a different lifestyle, obviously. And what he found was mind-blowing. He gave his research report at that conference about the difference in diseases that are often considered so prevalent in both city dwellers and in a particular community where we're seeing high blood pressure, high cholesterol levels, a lot of obesity, a lot of diabetes, a lot of heart disease, and yet those exact genetically similar individuals who had a completely different lifestyle did not suffer the same fate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty powerful. It's not like an afterthought, but how to get that information to people to the place where they're motivated to create change, I think, is a challenge.
Well, you know, a lot of times I have the discussion where, you know, just kind of ask yourself, look at your grandparents and your great-grandparents. Look at the way they ate. They didn't eat like we ate, and they had a lot more exposure to the outdoors, and they had a they worked, so they exercised, And they lived a long time. I mean, my great-grandmother lived to be 104 years old and probably would still be around if she hadn't caught pneumonia. But their diet was just totally different. So, you know, I personally try and go on a mantra where I tell my patients to try and have at least 2 to 3 meatless meals every week and see if you can increase that. I mean, a lot of the diet that promotes heart-healthy health revolves around primarily a vegetarian diet for the most part. So I
That's
think
true.
There's something
to be
said.
And also home cooking versus takeout and packaged.
Exactly.
That's a big part
exactly.
of it, because processed food now and quickie, you know, stop in whatever, burger places, et cetera, mm-hmm. really have made eating out very cost effective, but not in the long run, as
healthy.
I actually show patients on a sheet. You know, it doesn't cost a lot to make cabbage soup. As a matter of fact, it's pennies a serving. And
it
you
is.
Can cook once a week if you work all the time and just have little frozen mm-hmm. containers of it that you made yourself in your freezer. And it's going to
yep.
vastly improve both your health and your budget.
And it's good for you. And it tastes good.
All of that. So it's such, you know, a really important tool that I think is lacking. I mean, I almost have to tell patients, like, they don't have a pot. They just don't cook. I don't know if you're coming across that at all. But they buy a lot of prepackaged stuff. Cooking to them is like warming up sort of fried fish that you buy frozen.
Mm.
And if you learn to read your labels, there's so many chemicals and toxins and bad fats
exactly.
in there, like trans fats. It's a change. But, you know, if you think back, like you brought up, Dr. Gaither, like a generation ago, most people's grandmothers actually cooked.
Yeah. Yeah. And you didn't see a lot of heart disease. You didn't see a lot of cancer. Mm-mm. You didn't see that.
That's right. And those things are spiking. And I think there's enough research to really relate that back to the diet. To me, motivational. And then when I met, and perhaps you're met with, well, I can't afford to cook, I actually have recipes that I hand people, which are involved with, you know, cabbage, onions, garlic, and if you want to mm-hmm. put some chicken in there too, and then I have actually a cost analysis. Okay, so this is really going to cost you with your big family about 57 cents a serving, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So can you beat that at the takeout joint? I don't think so when you're dropping $10
yeah,
a day, you know? And then we get
you
the
really
time
can.
Management pushback. I'm sure you hear that because people are working. To just stay just with the electric on, you sometimes have to work 3 jobs.
True.
You're getting
what I kind of
stressful.
Advise patients to do is, you know, have one day during the weekend and cook during the weekend. And then
that's
just
what
breathe.
I do. I do it, and I bet you do it, because we
yeah,
have time management issues as well. So, yeah, it has to be, and it really can be done in a 2 to 3 hour span for most people. You know,
mm-hmm. just cook.
Yeah, and then freeze or put in the refrigerator. And
mm-hmm.
and that is so helpful as well. Well, it's wonderful that you're there in your community with your level of expertise. And if you're giving, let's say, vitamin C, how would you know if somebody was deficient in vitamin C? Because as we know, our own body does not even make vitamin C.
You know, you can certainly check a value, and if the values are, I think it's below 200 picograms per milliliter, at that point they're deficient, you know, because normal is 200 to 500 picograms per milliliter, then you can always supplement that. And vitamin C, like vitamin D, is inexpensive.
It's not expensive to get, that's for sure. And, of course,
right.
people can increase their consumption. Even just something like squeezing lemon juice in a cup in the morning.
Lemon juice. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's cost-effective, easy, really cleanses your system and gives you some vitamin C. Using rose hips is a good way to go, as well as vitamin C supplements. Now, I
mm-hmm.
haven't seen doctors always measuring vitamin C levels. Is that available?
You know, yes, it is available. Is it a test that's commonly done? No.
Yeah, I rarely see it actually measured.
Oh, you know what? I gave you the wrong values. Vitamin C is 0.4 to 1.7 milligrams per deciliter. Vitamin B12 is the 200 picograms. Sorry about that.
Dr. Keisha, that is no problem at all, because it's not a matter of those values. But when anyone gets any blood test done, I always make sure that all patients get copies of their blood work so they can see the reference range, which, of course, even the ones you gave, thank you for correcting it, but, you know, we can look at our tests, and it's clearly on the test. And, in fact, different labs sometimes even have slightly different values. So
you still can
see, where are you? Are you towards the low normal? Are you towards the high normal? Because your doctor, unless you have a knowledgeable doctor like Dr. Keisha, will usually not bring anything up unless it's out of range. But being in range but towards the too high or too low part of the range is important to know, so you can modify your intake and bring it into a balance. So there's so much that we can get from actually looking at our own blood tests with our doctors.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an important thing to do. Now, what is going on with premature birth? And I'm asking that because my grandson, who's now 7, he weighed 1 pound when he was born.
Oh, wow.
And that, you know, he's a micro mini. He's got severe brain damage, of course. And, you know, there seems to be, it was packed in there in the micro mini prenatal unit.
Wow. Well, you know, preterm labor is, I think, multifactorial. I think it has a lot to do with your environment. I think it has a lot to do with your micronutrient intake. It has a lot to do with infection. It has a lot to do with genetics. So, and also, I think it has a lot to do with the vaginal microdome, as some people like to talk about, the different types of flora that are in, you know, certain women's vaginal system or genital system. I think it's a combination of all three. I mean, not of all three, but all of that. It's multifactorial.
I think so. And this particular daughter, who's the mother of that mini child, she had a lot of those because she had recently had bariatric surgery. She was nutritionally deficient. She had just lost 200 pounds. She had all kinds of stressful conditions going on in her life. So it definitely is that portrait you just painted.
Stress plays a lot of stress plays a goodly amount of that too.
So what do you think? If the city is a specific problem, or is this premature birth rate, you know, more widespread?
Oh, it's widespread. I think it's widespread. Do you see more of it in the urban centers? I would think so, but, you know, I have no gauge really to say what it would be like, say, in rural Iowa. So, you know, I don't know. I can only extrapolate. You know, more stress likely in an urban environment as opposed to a rural environment. But to actually have, you know, statistics and numbers to compare and say, yes, this is definitively the case, I don't have that at my fingertips. But I'm sure that the March of Dimes would probably be a good reference point of view to actually take a look nationwide and see where the higher rates are. I know just as a general practice in the New York area, Brooklyn and the Bronx have some pretty high statistics as far as preterm birth is concerned. You know, we're in the 18%, you know, preterm birth, depending
18%?
On where you look at.
Doctor, that's kind of shocking.
In some regions.
18% is a very high number for preterm, you know,
high.
Or for anything out of, let's say, just what normally was. That is really
high.
You can track that's been increasing, let's say, from the 1950s.
I would think so. I would really think so. And, you know, I don't know if it has to do, you know, I think a certain percentage of it is the fact that we now are able to do reproductive science you know, there are more multiples being born now because of that. And the higher you go as far as your multiples, the more preterm they're likely to be at birth, simply because the uterus can't hold all those babies at one time. And, you know, you're going to go into preterm labor simply from the overdistension. But,
you know, if there's twins or something like that.
Twins and triplets and quads and sextuplets, yeah. I mean, we have the capability scientifically now to induce that type of thing. So I think that in and of itself contributes a lot to the prematurity that we see. But I still think that in comparing the 50s to now, there's still a higher percentage of babies being born preterm.
So that's some of the reasons that probably the rate has actually grown.
That's one of the reasons, definitely, you know, assisted reproductive technologies, as they call them.
Well, one thing I certainly have to say is in terms of care, I think that's one of the places that conventional medicine shines, in that many of these preterm infants would not really live without some of the more advanced interventions that you would do in the hospital.
They wouldn't. They would not. Mm-mm. You're absolutely correct about that.
And, you know, even, and I have to say, my little grandson, he does have challenges, but what a delicious person. And, you know, thank God for modern conventional medicine that literally saved his life. And also I found that the nurses in the NICU are extremely loving. So I know you've done research, I'm sure, about caring touch and how that influences patients across the board.
It does. It really does. I take my hats off to the nursing staff to take care of the little preemies. I mean, just the fact for them to find veins to hydrate these little people, it's amazing. I mean, they're so tiny. It makes me nervous to go into the NICU, but they do their job. They do their job well.
Yeah, and it is challenging. But they also did a great job, I know, with our family in actual education about how to handle the infants, so they maximized our ability to interact and bond, which I thought was just spectacular. It wasn't, oh, stay outside the glass. You know, they had
to
do the, you know, correct. Well, I'm a nurse, so I know, but my daughter and the baby's father doing the correct scrubbing technique, being able to touch the baby even when he was too little to be held. I was very impressed. I was really very impressed. And so I guess, you know, some of the vitamin issues can certainly be involved with preterm birth as well.
Yeah, you know, particularly vitamin D. So I think you're going to hear more and more research coming out about this little wonder vitamin, and we'll see where it goes with that.
It's true. So also, what about carbon monoxide? Because we all know that, you know, there's a big issue right now. Some people think carbon monoxide is great. We should put more carbon in the atmosphere, as we're hearing sometimes from politicians in the news. And yet we know that carbon monoxide can be destructive to our health.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, with cigarette smoking and, you know, car emissions and so forth and so on, carbon monoxide is toxic. It displaces oxygen from your red blood cells. So, you know, you're basically suffocating yourself if you are around, you know, either machinery that produces a lot or, you know, cars with their transmissions or even, you know, imbibing and doing a lot of smoking. So not a good thing.
And so, yeah, so where does that come from? You're saying that it comes. Now, what about parents who smoke cigarettes?
Not good. Not good. Not good. Because, you know, not only are you putting a lot of carbon monoxide in the environment that your baby is growing up in, and by the way, you know, smoking around a baby increases his risk of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, That's one reason why you shouldn't. But the other thing is the things that are in cigarettes, besides the carbon monoxide, you know, you've got a lot of curative agents that cure the tobacco, which are toxic, which are directly toxic. If you're pregnant and you're smoking, you know, some of the curative agents in tobacco are directly toxic to the placenta, you know.
Isn't that amazing that they actually still push? I mean, you'll see billboards and, you know, you still see things promoting its use, even amongst us pregnant women. It's just, you know, it seems like they should really have more information publicly available on how dangerous that is. And I think a law was just passed that the cigarette smoke and the companies are supposed to be advertising about the ill effects of tobacco.
Yes, they do. They have it on the package, but you know, despite having that, some people still, you know, imbibe.
Well, it is addictive.
It is.
So that's one of the problems as well. And if you're going to smoke, are there any things that parents could do to ensure better health for their fetus? Let's say they're just not going to stop smoking. Is there anything else that you could recommend, or do they even share that with you, or did they tell you they stopped?
Yeah, because I always ask. You know, there's the patch that you can use. But a lot of times when you do a little show and tell and you tell people what cigarettes do and then you pull out your medical books and show them, I think that has a great impact. You know, my mother used to smoke, and I tried for a long time to get her to stop. But then when I started bringing some of my medical books home and actually showing her pictures of, you know, this is what your lungs look like, you know, after smoking, I think that serves to trigger something to have them stop that practice.
That's, you know, that's so great that you were able to explain that to her. And yeah, nothing like visual. I know there are some.
Nothing like it.
Right. There are some good commercials now, unfortunately, of people who are passing away from cancer, and they go, wow, I wish I didn't smoke, you know, and they're pretty horrendous, but that's actually wonderful, let's say, for a young girl who is pregnant. How is the teenage pregnancy rate doing in your area?
I wouldn't say it's a lot, but it is present. I have some 15-year-olds that I take care of, so it's present, not a lot of it.
Well, how about in the past? You've been in this field for a long time. I'm just wondering if programs, more recent programs, which are about to be discontinued, of making birth control more available to younger women, even with Planned Parenthood, and perhaps you have a clinic there, and they're looking to, you know, backtrack and not make those things available.
Kind of scary.
So you've seen a decrease from the time that it is available, and you can do education and even, you know, supply people with what they need to make a better decision, which is going to help their health and the community's health and save money.
Yes. I think the dissolution of a lot of these programs is not going to fare well. It's not going to fare well at all.
Well, not for the public who needs it, that's for sure.
Exactly. And a lot of people need it.
Yes, I agree. Oh. So we're getting to the end of our discussion here. You have been an absolutely wonderful guest. And I'd still like you to talk a little bit about, you know, healthy blood cells and how what that has to do with DNA, because many people have heard of DNA and why that's important.
Well, there's certain micronutrients like vitamin B12, which assist in making your blood cells healthy. Now, when you start making unhealthy blood cells or having things which affect your DNA, that increases your risk of cancer. So, you know, you want to make sure that what your body is making is healthy and normal. So, like I said, you know, vitamin B12 is really important in keeping the blood cells healthy and making normal DNA, which is the genetic material in all of your cells. So you don't want to do anything that's going to increase your risk of cancer.
And also in terms of urban environments, we can support that there's a lot, you know, we talked about problems. There's also a lot that's really positive. In fact, there seems to be an influx of younger people to urban areas. I'm seeing that a lot.
True.
I mean, what about the availability of all access to all kinds of things? And I'm also seeing in many neighborhoods, but perhaps there's also food deserts, much higher availability as you're just walking the streets of Manhattan to make a healthy choice.
There are. So, I mean, it's not all bad, but certainly depending on where you're living, one of the things that I certainly would advocate is getting out more and getting some sunlight. And
that's
if you can't
a good
do
one.
That, yeah, if you can't, and, you know, we've got beautiful parks here, so in the summertime, that's not a problem. In the wintertime, that may be more of a challenge. So, you know, yes, everybody likes to curl up in front of the TV with your little mug of hot chocolate or whatever, but sometimes it would be best to at least 30 minutes a day out in the sun to try and get your vitamin D concentrations up and your body making some good things.
So true. Well, what kind of parting comments would you have for our guests?
Not for our guests, but for our listeners. I think my basic thing that I always tell people, seek prenatal care early. I can't emphasize that enough. It helps you, and it certainly helps the little person that you're carrying. So seek prenatal care early. And there are plenty of places that you can link into to get prenatal care.
Well, thank you so much. And we've been listening today to our guest, Dr. Keisha Gaither, who's double board certified physician, OBGYN, and maternal fetal medicine. And if she tells you to get prenatal health early, I highly suggest that you do that. And she also shared with us a great website, nutrienpower.org. Dr. Keisha, thank you so much for being our guest today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Thank you so much for having me. It was always a pleasure.
Okay, and be well.